If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Sweet Tarts dared to combine sweet and tart, but we didn't stop there. We combined soft and bouncy to bring you new Sweet Tarts Gummies Fruity Splits, a uniquely delicious dual-sided gummy with one side that's sweet and one side that's tart, but entirely smooth and squishy. Mmm, a powerfully perfect combo. Sweet Tarts, dare to combine.
Buzz around artificial intelligence is seemingly everywhere. Is your portfolio keeping up? Consider the Global X Artificial Intelligence and Technology ETF, ticker AIQ, which invests in dozens of stocks at the leading edge of this disruption. Investing involves risk, including possible loss of principal. Technology companies can be affected by rapid product obsolescence and intense industry competition. Before investing, carefully consider the fund's objectives, risks, charges, expenses, and more in the full or summary prospectus at globalxetfs.com. Read carefully. Distributed by SEI Investments Distribution Co.
Hello, and welcome to the BBC History Magazine podcast. I'm Rob Attar, Deputy Editor of the magazine. This is the second of our January 2012 episodes. Don't forget, BBC History Magazine is on sale in all good newsagents and on subscription. Visit our website, historyextra.com, for more information. Or you can follow us at twitter.com/historyextra or facebook.com/historyextra. Coming up this week, we have...
She kept on wearing this excessively large neckerchief. She refused to take it off despite being warned frequently.
That was Sheila Ogilvie talking about how clothing was regulated in early modern Europe.
The question, as they put it, is how were the pyramids built by people who worshipped vetches, leeks, onions and even cheese?
And that was David Gange on Victorian views of ancient Egypt. Nowadays, when you go to the shops, you'll probably be able to buy almost anything you like without worrying about the legal consequences. That, however, has not always been the case. In many parts of Europe in the early modern period, there were strict rules about what different classes of people could and couldn't consume. Professor Sheila Ogilvie of Cambridge University has been researching these consumption regulations as part of a project on buying habits in southwestern Germany. I spoke to her recently about how these laws operated and what the consequences might have been. You and your team are currently researching sumptuary laws in early modern Germany. What exactly were these laws?
Well, sumptuary laws are what they say they are, which is they're legal prescriptions that try to regulate what people can consume. And they mostly focused on trying to stop people from wearing, eating, drinking, and doing for fun things that the respectable classes didn't want them to do. So they mostly took the form of laws against luxurious clothing or big banquets or having too many guests at your wedding party, playing music, dancing, all sorts of luxury expenditures.
And when you're talking there about respectable classes, does that indicate that these laws didn't apply to everyone across society?
Well, they tended to follow social gradations. So one major motivation for having them was that the higher social strata, or the traditional groups that had enjoyed high social status but perhaps saw themselves as being threatened by new upwardly mobile groups, wanted to demarcate their status vis-a-vis these lower strata, or especially the sort of nouveau riche strata. So they often laid down what clothing you could wear if you were of a particular social rank, and forbade people below that rank to wear things like fancy furs or imported textiles, or to invite more than 12 people to their weddings. So really, sumptuary laws were often quite lax for better-off people, for courtiers, for members of the nobility, but quite strict for people, peasants, ordinary artisans.
So it was a way of kind of keeping the masses down.
Well, that was one motivation for them. But actually, sometimes the elite used them against one another. So there would be a tendency for people who were, for example, a village vicar might try to use the sumptuary regulations against another member of the professional classes who he saw as, in a sense, challenging his monopoly over what it meant to be an educated professional living in a village. So although the sumptuary ordinances were often used by higher social strata against lower ones, that was only one of many motivations. Sometimes the higher social strata used them against each other.
And so in theory, could someone from the lower social strata use it against someone from the higher strata?
Probably in theory they could, but I've never encountered an example of that happening. It was mostly used either against people who were more or less on the same level as you, or against people who were below you. I've never, at least in our research on early modern Germany, I've never encountered it being used in a sort of upward direction.
And who were the people who created these laws?
Well, again, that varied a great deal across different societies, because I've mentioned one group, which are the higher social strata, wanting to demarcate their status vis-a-vis the sort of nouveau riche, or the cits, or the chavs of that time. But there were respectable male householders who wanted to define gender-specific conduct, prevent sexual disorder, help themselves resist their wives and daughters' demand for new fashions. So there was quite a strong misogynistic strain to a lot of European sumptuary ordinances to restrain the barbarous and irrepressible bestiality of women, in the words used by one Italian sumptuary ordinance. So there was men trying to control women. There were employers who wanted to reduce servants' temptation to demand higher wages. There were guild masters who wanted to require ordinary people to wear domestically produced textiles and furs in order to protect their own markets against foreign competition. And of course, there were churchmen. There are always religious guys who want to restrain worldly adornment and lavish sociability. I don't think it was just that the religious groups wanted to restrict luxury, but I think they truly believed, in some cases, that God was angry at human beings and would actually punish people by, for example, inflicting war on the village or inflicting an epidemic on the village if the sumptuary ordinances weren't observed. I mean, certainly one of the two villages that we're studying for our project, which is a small village in southwest Germany, one village vicar actually wrote down in the church court records in 1703 that it was necessary to fine a group of young men who were playing and listening to music on Sundays, because God, who is already angry on account of our misdeeds, will be moved to persecute us further and discipline us more with the rod of war. And the reason he said that in 1703 was that the village had actually been burnt down by a group of soldiers earlier in that year. So clearly, religious people really believed that if you allowed luxury to take off in your village, something bad would happen to you.
And how exactly were these rules enforced?
Well, I think that where they were enforced, and of course they weren't always effectively enforced, but in the places in Europe where they were effectively enforced, it was usually because there was a combination of a central government that was willing to pass these laws and some local mechanism, usually a community court or a church court, that really functioned effectively so that local people could report one another. Because, of course, you know, the central government doesn't know what kind of clothes you're wearing or whether you're playing music on Sundays or how many guests you invited to your wedding. But your neighbors know. And so what you need in order for sumptuary ordinances to be enforced is usually a small face-to-face community where people know what each other are doing, and then an institutional mechanism like a church court or a communal court where people can report each other.
And so you'd require quite a lot of public support for these laws if you were relying on the public to be going to authorities and telling them when people have broken them.
Yes, and so I suspect that what we'll find is that it was only certain aspects of the sumptuary ordinances that were enforced, and that a lot of the provisions in them were simply ignored. So it really, like every aspect of government, certainly in pre-industrial times, the effectiveness of what the central state could do relied very much on cooperation from the local level. So unless there were respectable groups or very influential groups on the local level that had an interest in allying with the central state to enforce some law, usually it didn't happen.
What kind of punishments could people expect if they flouted these laws?
Well, they could be fined, as we discussed in our article. Often, quite large fines for people at the time, several days' wages, sometimes up to 11 or 14 days' wages. Occasionally, if they were very bolshy and very sort of impertinent in the communal court, they might be put in the stocks or put in the sort of village lockup for a few hours, usually not longer than that. There was a lot of, I think, informal pressure placed on you. So, for example, in the story that we tell in our article, Magdalena Schöttlin, she was only fined by her community court after a lot of informal pressure had been placed on her and hadn't worked. So what she was doing was she kept on wearing this excessively large neckerchief. She refused to take it off despite being warned frequently. And then the vicar preached a sermon one Sunday castigating sartorial display, and as far as we can tell, probably naming Magdalena Schöttlin. So there was a sort of naming and shaming. And then a few days later, Magdalena was sitting around with a group of friends and remarked that if the vicar didn't have anything better to preach about than fancy neckcloths, he could well leave off preaching altogether. And you can't help applauding her for being that bolshy. But of course, for Magdalena, it was a really bad move because, of course, someone couldn't resist reporting this to the village elders. She was summoned to appear before the church court, and it was only then that she actually had this fine imposed on her. So I think the people who were trying to impose the sumptuary regulations or trying to enforce them tried to use informal mechanisms for a long time before they actually punished you. But, you know, there could be quite serious controls placed on you. For example, in another example, which I think we mention in our article, a rather poor widow in her 50s applied for welfare support from her community court. And she was told that she couldn't have it because her grown-up son and daughter, who had moved away, so they weren't living with her, had been seen in clothing above what is fitting. So being denied welfare support because your grown-up children were wearing fancy clothing is a fairly severe punishment, I think.
Yeah, definitely. So were there lots of people like this Magdalena who would resist the rules?
Well, it's hard to tell because, of course, with any crime, there's always a sort of black figure. You don't know who the people are who are resisting it. I think we have the impression from looking in detail at the community court records that most people just tried to slip by. They bought fancy new gear, they wore it, they hoped no one would notice, or if they did notice, that they wouldn't report them. But sometimes you were caught, especially if you lived in a small community where everyone knew you, and especially if there were these institutional mechanisms like church courts to which you could be reported. And in that case, you would be hauled before the church court and reprimanded. People responded in various ways. Some of them apologized very, very self-abasingly and promised not to do it again. And that was actually a very good strategy. I mean, one shouldn't really interpret it as just being that they are abasing themselves. I think they reckoned, you know, if I abase myself, then maybe they won't find me. And often you do read in the margins of the church court that, you know, because he apologized and said he wouldn't do it again, we decided not to find him. But some, like Magdalena Schöttlin, were very ballsy. And they went on wearing their excessively large neckerchiefs or their excessively wide trousers. And when pressure was put on them, they kept on protesting until they were thrown in the village lockup. And then there were people who were more powerful and who could protest much more effectively. In the 1680s, one village pastor started using the clothes ordinances as a way of getting at another member of the village elite. It happened to be the barber surgeon and his wife. We don't really know why there was such hostility between these two educated professionals, but the vicar tried to fine the barber surgeon for having a very small ribbon on his coat and treated him disrespectfully in public at the town hall in front of a bunch of women. The whole town was talking about it for weeks. And the barber surgeon actually petitioned the central government in Stuttgart, and it gave rise to a whole series of court hearings. There was a feud between the two families that lasted for 9 years. So that was another way in which you could actually resist the enforcement of these sumptuary ordinances, was to fight back.
Overall, would you say that these ordinances worked? Did they really impact on what was consumed at the time?
It's hard to tell. That's one of the things that we're looking at in our project. Our project isn't, in fact, focused primarily on the sumptuary ordinances. What we're focused on is what people consumed in these small communities in the less developed center of Europe over a 300-year period, and what kind of factors affected it one way or another. And it was almost a surprise to us to find that we knew, of course, that these sumptuary ordinances existed, but we were a bit surprised to find that they were enforced. And we were very surprised to find that there was actually at least some quite systematic enforcement. Some registers survive with lists of names describing exactly what people were wearing and what they were fined for wearing. Clearly, at some periods, there was systematic enforcement. And we do know by now that the adoption of new consumption habits appears to have taken place somewhat later in this part of Germany and probably throughout German-speaking Central Europe, somewhat later than it did, for example, in England or the Netherlands. And what we want to do is to see if there is some relationship between restrictions on consumption and the adoption or non-adoption of new fashions or new other forms of consumption. But it's really an open question. What we have now is we have the existence of these sumptuary laws. We've got evidence that sometimes they were enforced quite systematically. But what we want to do is bring that together with the information that we're gathering out of. We have thousands of personal inventories of lists of what people owned at marriage and at death. And what we want to do is look systematically at these inventories and say, do people own things that they weren't actually allowed to own according to the sumptuary ordinances? And I think it's only then that we'll be able to say definitively, yes, it looks as if these laws were one of the factors that caused the consumer revolution to come relatively late to Germany.
The sumptuary laws only really in Germany, or were they in other countries as well?
No, you find laws about what people can consume in very many societies over the past 20 centuries or more. They had sumptuary regulations in ancient Greece and Rome. They had them in China starting in the 3rd century and straight up to the 16th century. They were really strong sumptuary ordinances in Japan from the 17th to the 19th century. And of course, if you think about it, there are some modern examples. I mean, 20th century United States had prohibition of alcohol between 1919 and 1933. And that's what's called an alimentary sumptuary ordinance. So it's an ordinance about the consumption of a particular kind of food or drink. Even modern Western societies have laws about the consumption of alcohol, consumption of cannabis, consumption of trans fats in New York in the present day. And of course, you know, women's clothing, whether women go with bare heads or whether they wear the headscarf, all of those things, if you think about it, laws about what women can wear are sumptuary ordinances. So probably in every society that's ever existed, people have tried to control consumption, at least consumption by other people.
But is there something particular about Germany that made you want to focus on that country?
Well, sumptuary regulation does vary across societies. In Europe, nearly every society had sumptuary laws in the Middle Ages. But then sometime between 1500 and 1600, a very interesting divergence began, because in some European societies, existing sumptuary laws stopped being enforced and new ones stopped being passed. So in England, for instance, the last sumptuary law was passed in 1604. And even before that, the enforcement was so bad that, you know, you have Puritan preachers like Philip Stubbs writing in 1583 that nowhere is such a confused mingle-mangle of apparel as in England and such preposterous excess thereof. So England was seen both by English Puritans at the time and by foreign visitors as being a place where there were no restrictions on what people could wear. And the Dutch Republic, which came into being in 1581 after the Dutch rebelled against Spain, never passed any sumptuary laws. So you have these two very advanced North Atlantic societies where sumptuary laws all but disappeared by about 1600. And then on the other hand, around 1600, many other European societies started developing much more active central states and much more effective local bureaucracies. And in some of those societies, sumptuary laws began multiplying in number. And I think German-speaking Central Europe, Germany, Switzerland appear to be the places where we have quite a lot of evidence that there was systematic enforcement, at least in some places and sometimes. So the fact that you get this very interesting divergence in Europe, say around 1600, just at the point at which the consumer revolution is supposed to have started, you also get this divergence in sumptuary regulation, with some societies getting rid of it and others intensifying it, is something which makes Germany a very interesting sort of laboratory test for what the institutional preconditions might have been for the kind of beneficial takeoff in consumption, which economic historians are now thinking was one of the powerhouses that lay behind ultimate factory industrialization.
So potentially these sumptuary laws could be a major reason why Germany didn't industrialize anything like as early as a country like Britain.
Well, they could be a reason. Economists and historians still don't know what all the factors are that cause economic growth and development. But we do know that a lot of the key changes happened in exactly this period we're looking at, the period before the first factories. And this idea of a consumer revolution, that economic growth is caused by people being motivated by the possibility of buying new, cheap, attractive, fashionable things in the market and supplying more of their time to the market in order to earn the money so that they can buy these things. This whole idea of a consumer revolution is certainly one of the most powerful new theories which economic historians have come up with to explain why economic growth really predates the first factories. And you can see what sumptuary regulations will do to that kind of consumer revolution virtuous circle. If you stop less well-off people and women and young people from being allowed to buy and wear fancy clothes, or you increase the costs and risks of that sort of new consumption by imposing penalties on it, then that chokes off that huge motivation for people to supply more time to the market so that they can buy these new consumer objects. So I think it would be exaggerated to say that restrictions on consumption are the only thing that delay might have delayed the growth of the economy in German-speaking Central Europe. But they may have been one of a number of restrictions on both consumption and, of course, production, and especially the consumption and production choices of women, which slowed down this kind of beneficial pre-modern economic growth that we think was necessary for industrialization to happen in the end.
And finally, when and why did these sumptuary laws disappear in German-speaking Europe?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and it's something that we hope to get some answers to by tracing changes in consumption over time. One thing which seems to have played a role was actually the French Revolution, which may sound a bit strange because you think, oh, why did the French Revolution affect Germany? But it did, in the sense that there's an increasing volume of research which suggests that France actually exported its revolution to other parts of Europe. And there were spillover effects from France into neighboring bits of Germany. And certainly, although France didn't have as many or as strongly enforced sumptuary regulations as Germany did, one of the big things that was abolished with the French Revolution in France were sumptuary regulations. And in the German states, you see a growth in, if you like, radical thinking toward the end of the 18th century, with people echoing some of the French thinkers saying, you know, why are we restricting what people can wear? Is this really the kind of society that we want to be? Isn't it just counterproductive? And so it may have been the influence of French revolutionary ideas, or it may simply have been that finally there were a lot of changes taking place in the institutional structures inside German economies around the end of the 18th and the beginning of the 19th century. So, for example, the guilds were being broken down. And if you remember, one of the motivations behind sumptuary ordinances were guild masters who wanted to prevent luxury imports and force ordinary people to consume domestic textiles. So the guilds were being broken down, serfdom was being broken down in a lot of parts of Germany that still had it around the beginning of the 19th century. All sorts of traditional institutions and traditional privileges were being broken down, and the abolition of the sumptuary ordinances may simply have been part of that wider social transformation, which really freed up the immense entrepreneurial energies inside German society, so that after about 1900, you see really, really fast economic growth in Germany. A sort of the first German economic miracle took place during the 19th century, where Germany went from really being a less developed economy to being one of the richest and most successful economies in the world by the end of the century. And a lot of it was due to this sort of institutional change that took place after 1800.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
That was Professor Sheila Ogilvy. You can read an article co-written by her in our January 2012 issue. Now it's time for our historical trivia moment. Today's trivia has been submitted by James McGovern, a listener from Dublin. He writes to tell us about the story of Boston Corbett, the man who shot and killed Lincoln's assassin, John Wilkes Booth, in 1865. Corbett himself was a troubled individual who in 1887 threatened officers of the Kansas legislature with a pistol. He later escaped from a mental asylum. If anyone would like to email in with further interesting historical facts, we'll gladly read them out here, if they're true, of course, and we'll give you a name check in return. Email us at podcast@historyextra.com with any of your curious historical facts. Our second interview this week is with David Gange, a historian at Birmingham University. Gange specialises in the history of religion, the history of Near Eastern archaeology, and the development of historical thought. Editor Dave Musgrove caught up with him to bring these strands of his research together in a discussion of how the study of ancient Egypt ignited minds in 19th century Britain and impacted on social and religious attitudes here as well.
You've been doing an interesting research project looking at 19th century Egypt and Egyptology. So the first question that springs to mind is, who was interested in Egypt in the 19th century and why?
Okay, one of the things I find really interesting about Egyptology in this period is that so many different people are interested in it, partly because of the biblical elements concerned. So when historians look at 19th century religion, usually they have their kind of elite clergymen who they can study, and then they have the popular religion, they can look at how many people are attending church and things, whereas texts on Egyptology move into both these groups. So you can find young people wandering around poor areas of London and writing to British Museum curators about an Egyptological text they've written, and you can find the Archbishop of Canterbury giving his comments on exactly the same text. So it's a really useful way of working out how ideas are circulating between lots of different social groups.
And is there a particular reason why Egypt sprung to interest in the 19th century? I'd always been of interest to people, and it just happens that's what you're researching.
There are lots of reasons why all the Egyptian interest really comes out in the 19th century. The first one is political. So in 1798, Nelson defeats Napoleon's fleet in the Battle of the Nile, and there's lots and lots of really nationalistic interest in Egypt, in Britain, at that point.
The French having previously invaded Egypt.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And the Rosetta Stone is found then and taken by the British from the French. And then there are kind of 20 odd years during which there's an attempt to try and work out what this script means. And at the same time, you get lots and lots of shows in London using Egyptian material. It's the most famous one associated with the circus strongman, Giovanni Battista Belzoni. And yeah, then the rest of the century after 1822 and decipherment is spent trying to work out how this language can be used to interpret Egyptian material. And at the same time, there are lots of changes going on in how the Bible is interpreted. So lots of ideas coming from Germany in the late 18th century challenging traditional ways of reading the biblical text. And they reach British readers during the 19th century, and archaeology becomes a really useful tool against those textual interpretations, those textual deconstructions.
Okay, we'll come back to that in a second. So through the 19th century then, was Egypt basically open house to people from Britain? Could they go there fairly easily and explore at will?
The laws gradually tighten up across the 19th century. I mean, it's phenomenally expensive to get to Egypt and do much digging. Earlier on in the 19th century, it gets cheaper quite quickly in the mid-19th century. By 1869, you even have Thomas Cook's tours going to Egypt. But by the mid-century, you have an antiquity service founded, which is run by French archaeologists who jealously guard their territory. So the thing that really stops British Egyptologists excavating at will later in the century is actually competition with the French rather than kind of ideas of Egyptian sovereignty, which the British trample all over until into the 20th century.
Okay. Let's talk about the Rosetta Stone for a second and the decipherment. So that's sort of the first stage of interest in Egyptology, you were saying, in the first couple of decades of the 19th century. That's where interest is focused. Is that right?
Well, yes, the interest is political at that point. I think the Rosetta Stone is a little bit of a red herring there. It's about this defeat of the French. Mm. And it's about images of Egypt coming into circulation in Britain in a much bigger way than they had before, which is, of course, partly about cheaper printing. But the race to decipher the hieroglyphs, as it's called, is a little bit mythical, I think. There's much less interest in that in the British press than you might expect. And also, once Champollion actually publishes... Once Jean-François Champollion, the French decipherer, publishes his letter to Monsieur Dacier, in which he shows the work that he's done on decipherment and shows that he can read texts, there's very little interest in that in Britain. Champollion is assumed to be wrong for a long time. There's a great phrase from the Arctic explorer, John Barrow, who says that Champollion is wandering into a maze of theory and will lose himself in the inextricable labyrinth. Even in 1829, the Marquis Spinetto's lectures at Cambridge, it's argued that no progress has been made in hieroglyphs, and even when they are, just confusion will follow for decades. And this is usually interpreted as being competition, national competition again. So this French decipherer is dismissed because the British want to claim decipherment for Thomas Young, a British polymath. But they're just as dismissive of Thomas Young in reality. He's assumed to be losing himself in the same kind of paradoxical thinking. It's argued by travellers, such as Robert Richardson, that it's going to be decades until someone deciphers it, that the true decipherer has not yet been born. So one thing that this means for Egyptology is that that idea of Egyptology becoming professional in the 1820s and 30s, becoming scientific rather than this kind of amateur collecting beforehand, is just nonsense. The idea of a scientific professional Egyptology is a much, much later one, from the 1890s, the 1900s, the 1910s. Until that point, biblical ideas of Egypt and classical ideas of Egypt, ones associated with Greece in particular, are manipulated, and Egypt itself is pulled between these two models, that biblical model and that Greek model. It has very little identity of its own until much later.
Okay, so let's talk a bit about what you're saying about the analysis of the Bible and the text of the Bible and how that impacted on Egyptology. So what's going on there? What's the story that underlies that?
So the late 18th century, we have lots of scholars in German universities, in particular places like Göttingen and Tübingen, working on the origins of biblical texts. the kind of documents that lie behind biblical texts. So they're assuming that the Bible isn't this unitary document given by God to Moses and written down, but is something that's been compiled over time by ancient Hebrews to try and explain their national past. And this is hugely controversial. It's controversial in Germany, but it's even more controversial in Britain, which is going through this period of religious revival that we call the Evangelical Revival. And to begin with, Egyptology is seen as a kind of radical pursuit. Famous German Baron Bunsen, who's a friend of royalty in both Britain and Germany, writes a huge Egypt's Place in Universal History, which attempts to make Egyptian monuments seem much, much older than people in Britain had accepted them as up to this point. But as the century goes on, British scholars realise that Egyptology can actually be used in the opposite way. The kind of the associations that Egypt has are switched. So from being Bunsen's attack on the Old Testament as literal historical truth, Egyptology begins to be used in defence of the Bible. By going out and finding the Exodus route, you can prove that the Exodus happened, as it's said in the Bible.
So Egyptologists become sort of guardians of the Bible in a sense then?
Absolutely. By the 1880s and 90s, when the first organised British excavations in Egypt take place, the appeals for subscriptions for funding that Egyptological organisations make is to the church and chapel going public who want to defend the biblical text. The first organised British excavations in Egypt are an attempt to find the Exodus route and to excavate the cities along the way. What they really want to find is a Hebrew patriarch with his texts on him. He would have been buried with biblical texts that would go back long before the documents they have at that point.
And they've yet to find that, though.
Oh, they're absolutely yet to find that, yeah.
and this is why, as you've pointed out to me in an email, that a 19th century Archbishop of Canterbury chose to call his cat after the Egyptian god Ra.
That is true, yes. Edward White Benson, who was Archbishop of Canterbury from 1883 to 1896, had a whole family who were extraordinarily interested in ancient Egypt. His son, E.F. Benson, wrote short stories about ancient Egypt. His daughter, who was a slightly mystical character, but still a good Protestant, wrote of offering prayers to the Sphinx. She found in Egypt exactly those kind of confirmations of the Bible, but also a more mystical version of her Protestantism. And her father, who was very interested in the Eastern question, the political British political engagement with what was going on in the old Ottoman Empire throughout the 19th century, saw Egyptology as a powerful confirmation of what the British could do to demonstrate the power of the biblical text.
But there's another element to interest in Egyptology, which is this idea that it was in some way hinged to industrialisation and was being used by the industrialists, by the working men, to sort of tie in with what they were doing. So tell me a bit about that.
Yes, my favourite example of this is a debate, a very fiery debate, in Newcastle in the 1820s. In fact, it happens in 1822. It's a much bigger story in Britain than Champollion is, than decipherment is in 1822, when the people of Newcastle and their antiquarian society receive a mummy from Thebes. And it happens at the same time as a new journal is launching, the Newcastle magazine. And they devote lots of the first few issues to ancient Egypt. And they establish this question of whether the Egyptians should be seen as these kind of industrious engineering people, or whether they are crude pagans with nothing to say. The question, as they put it, is how were the pyramids built by people who worshipped vetches, leeks, onions, and even cheese? And the debate that strikes up is really intriguing in that the Anglican establishment almost universally dismiss ancient Egypt as the ancient Egyptians as a people who could worship nothing better than dogs, whereas the nonconformists, the more radical figures, are willing to see ancient Egypt as this really industrious, productive ancient society. And they use ancient Egypt to try and inspire the working people of Newcastle to count industry as part of their identity, to make manufacturing something inspirational and with a huge ancient pedigree. So what they're doing in one way is they feel that the establishment owns Greece and Rome. That established people educated at Oxford and Cambridge or brought up through the established church have this tradition of study of Greece and Rome. So the nonconformists want to elevate ancient Egypt above Greece to claim their own ancient history. They're trying to rewrite ancient history at the same time as they're trying to rewrite the political order in the present by pushing manufacturing above landed wealth and by pushing for democratic voting.
Okay. So it strikes me that in most Victorian regional museums, they all appear to have had some sort of mummy or Egypt display, and even today you can still see a lot of Egyptian exhibitions in far-flung parts of Britain. Did the Victorian and 19th century and Victorian later Victorian people flock to these exhibitions? Were they infused by Egypt, or as you were talking about the decipherment, were they slightly ambiguous about the whole thing?
It's strange how quickly this can change across decades. I mean, that Newcastle example, when the mummy is put on display, it gets many more visitors than they ever had for anything else. But someone in the first few days steals the painted footboard of the mummy. And it's the first thing that Newcastle ever has to put behind glass. Their first kind of museum exhibit in the modern sense of being closed off behind glass. So it had caused quite a stir there. The Egyptian exhibits in the British Museum were famous for drawing in holiday crowds and people with a more passing interest. So the British Museum authorities tried to guide people away from Egyptian material and bring them onto the supposedly more elevating items from Greece and Rome. And mummy unwrappings, of course, were very, very popular, especially by the 1840s. Huge crowds in very, very large halls that were usually used for big popular entertainments would gather to watch these mummies being unravelled and to smell these mummies being unravelled. And especially once we get to the 1880s, once Britain has actually occupied Egypt and a lot more material comes back because you've got kind of military transport going backwards and forwards from Egypt, then Egyptian exhibits, especially in the northwest of England, become really, really popular. Part of the northwest connection, I think, is the cotton trade in the northwest. Lots of cotton coming up to Egypt and bringing with it mummies and statuary, things like that.
Okay, last question. Obviously, today there's a very big debate about whether these objects from antiquity should be in British museums. Was there any discussion in the 19th century about whether it was correct that they were coming over?
There was, but it was usually pretty peripheral. It was usually assumed until in the 1920s. Tutankhamun is a really important moment for this in 1922. It was assumed that Europeans had interest in the past and that Egyptian people lived purely in the present, that they didn't have a historical interest. So it was assumed that archaeologists were in fact protecting these items from the Egyptians and should get them out of Egypt if they could. It's with Tutankhamun that European Egyptologists stop being able to ignore the Egyptian national interest in history. The peripheral interest earlier on comes from people like the slightly crazy American lawyer Francis Cope Whitehouse, who thought that the pyramids were huge water towers that the biblical Joseph had built. He presses quite early on for all archaeology in Egypt to operate in the same way as the archaeology of Pompeii had earlier on. So archaeologists should never try to stock museums, but they should always try to recreate ancient cities on their original sites. But the kind of mad ideas he associated these with meant that that idea didn't really get much take-up in Britain.
David Gange is lecturer in British history at the University of Birmingham. His book, Egyptology in British Culture and Religion, should be published by Oxford University Press later this year or early in 2013. Well, that's all for this week's episode. I hope you'll join us again next week for a Captain Scott special edition. BBC History Magazine's weekly podcast is recorded in Bristol and produced by the meticulous Dave Gibson. Thanks for listening. Thank you.